Hello, my name is Dr. Vanessa Kimball and I am a baker. But I'm also someone who has studied and researched the impact of bread on our health for many years. I run the Sourdough School in Northamptonshire and my specialism is bread and the gut microbiome and the impact on our mental health. But I'm also trained as a nutrigenetic practitioner, meaning I look at the way that bread impacts people according to their genetics. It helps me to personalize bread. And in this podcast, I'm going to be chatting to someone who I hope you are going to find as interesting as I did. What I'd love is for you to listen and think about the bread that you bake, eat and share with your family. Because bread is a staple, it's our most basic food and I believe it is the foundation to good health. Just say hi. A little bit of context really for people who don't know you. Some people will be listening for the first time. Can you just tell me a little bit about Homidods and a little bit about how you know so much about UK farming, please?
Hi, Vanessa, and thank you. I think what's really interesting is the more I know, the realize the less I actually know. You know, that there's such a huge amount to understand about the system that provides us with the food that we need, but it's also, you know, fundamental to the way our landscape has been shaped over millennia, frankly. You know, that there is just this huge unraveling that one gets involved in. It's like pulling a thread. So I started really as an ecologist, you know, with a real interest in how natural systems work and how we fit into those systems. And I suppose really in the late 90s, early 2000s, it became really clear to me that something that's actually missing from a lot of ecological conversations is people. And, you know, we are a fundamental part of those systems. And we've spent sort of 300 or 400 years largely removing ourselves from the ecosystems that support us through processes of industrialization. And those processes have happened on farms as well. And I think food is just this major kind of opportunity to help people re-engage with the world around them, because we all eat. And that getting that understanding of how food is produced and what goes into filling the plate in front of you 3 times a day is just so critical. And Homidods, which is a business that I founded with two friends in 2012, is really our response to market failure. Market failure being, you know, the wrong signals are sent to farmers by retailers, by government policy, and we end up with a food system that does not serve us well. It doesn't serve our health well. It doesn't serve the living systems that we depend on well. And we're really seeing that played out across the world, in fact. So Homidod really is just about how do we create these connections direct to farm that support farmers, support the landscape within which those farmers operate, and also deliver health benefits to us as eaters.
That failure is, I think, something that most people who come to the Sourdough School and most of my students are feeling, not just in terms of an emotional sense, but I think many people are feeling it because their health is failing. It's a reflection. It comes direct back to our own system. And people think that the food system has nothing to do with them, but actually your own internal body and your system is completely connected to it. And that's why I think we're talking, because there is no, there's nothing that separates if the soil is wrong. We're not getting nourished. It is that simple. So my next question kind of leads me into that. So when you stand and you look at in a field and you look at a crop design, I've done this with you many times, what are you reading in that field that most of us miss?
Oh, I don't know if most of us miss it. I think what's more fundamental is most of us just don't have the opportunity to do that. We don't have the opportunity to walk into a middle of a field and get a sense of it. And I would challenge anyone to walk into a middle of a field and if they, even if they knew nothing about ecology or nothing about farming, they'd have a real sense of what is going on in that field. Because I think in an evolutionary sense, we're adapted to see abundance. We're adapted to see abundance wherever it is. We can see more shades of green than any other color because we need to. In order to sustain ourselves. So when you walk into a field of commodity grown cereals, that's cereals that's grown for global markets where yield and price are the key factors that decide what a farmer grows and how they grow it, you can really feel that because there's an absence. There's an absence of bird life, there's an absence of insects, there's an absence of wild plant species. And you can see that immediately and you can sense it. And what you're standing in the middle of is a monoculture that's made up of a single variety that has not been grown with our health in mind, that has been grown simply with the calorific value in mind, the yield at the end of the year for the farmer, which is the only thing that allows the farmer to have any control over the price they get from the global market.
So the beginning of what we call monobred, which means one commercial yeast, mono ingredients, meaning one, refined mono, and mono food starts with monoculture in the field, and you can literally see that. You and I stood at, I think, Wakelands on one side where diversity has been abundant, and we've looked across the fields into mono fields, and the starkness, it was like looking at a sort of different planet. Well, a different, I was gonna say different planet. It was a mono planet. It was quite stark, really, to see the contrast in that moment. I remember it very well.
Yeah, I mean, that is something I love doing with people when they visit Wakelands, which is this fantastic agroforestry system, which is full of diversity of crops, but also wild species as well. And over the way, across the ditch, is standard East Anglian monoculture, which has been developed, in response to the kind of reductive food system that's emerged since the Second World War, which is, produce volume, produce it at a price, and compete with global markets. And the difference could not be more stark. People often ask when they see Wakelands, what would it be like if Wakelands wasn't doing this? What would this field look like? And so you just need to cross the ditch and you'll feel it immediately because that's what it was before they started.
It's
And
stark,
that,
what I call
yeah. And that field, that monocultural approach, it's very cost effective. There's only one person involved in farming that field, inevitably, and they make infrequent visits, usually with a sprayer, in order to work the field across the year. And it's not really supporting jobs. Wakelands, on the other hand, about 60 acres is supporting, at least half a dozen jobs immediately on the land, but also quite a number of jobs that are part-time or that are associated with what happens at Wakelands. So, yeah, it's just a diverse, productive system. And I think coming back to the previous point, you can see that immediately. And I think when we started Hodmedod, one of the things that we realized really quickly is that with horticultural crops, with fruit and vegetables, with livestock, they're relatively easy to engage with. You can see them in the field. You can hold them in your hand. They don't need to go off for processing elsewhere in order to be turned into food on your plate. But with arable crops, cereals, beans, other pulses, seed crops, they are largely anonymous in the field. Most people don't recognize what they're driving past, whether it's barley or wheat or oats, and they need to go off in big lorries to be processed somewhere else to be turned into flour, which is then made into bread. And so they are invisible.
This is my next question. Tell me the story of how the crops get chosen, how they get treated, and how they end up in a commodity market. And then, of course, I'm going to ask you the opposite. So tell me the story, like almost like you're telling a story to a sort of child who has never thought about the way that it what the story is of how that grain got to even be planted. Tell me that story, because it's actually most people don't really know what it means for the grain to go even in this. They don't know what happens. So tell it to me, like, from start to finish, and then we'll look at the opposite side.
Farmers, like any businesses, are looking at ways that they can meet a set of needs that they have, which is to pay their bills and to provide an income and to live a livelihood that respects all their efforts and work. And to do that, they grow crops. And the only place that they can sell those crops is into traders who are connected to global markets. So the
So,
pro
but that's really serious. They can only sell it to these one customers, really. They can only sell it there.
Broadly, I mean, there are other smaller customers which we'll talk about, and we're one of those. But for the most part, farmers are selling into a limited number of customers, and the grain industry is dominated globally, but really by just four big businesses that trade grain globally.
And so just to stop you there for a second, that's mad when you think about it. Can the farm negotiate their price, Josiah?
Not usually. So there are things that farmers can do to attempt to achieve the best price, but they're fairly limited. So farmers can affect the yield, so the tons per hectare or per acre that they are harvesting will increase the return for them. And to do that, they use a set of agricultural inputs to help, like nitrogen and herbicides and fungicides and insecticides to do all that they can to increase yield. So essentially, they're producing a little bit more than their neighbor, so that although the price per ton is the same for everyone, they're getting a little bit more per acre back onto the farm. So they can do that. They can also do things like speculate on the futures market for wheat. So all of the financial instruments, or many of the main tools that the global financial sector uses, emerged from early agriculture. When you have a storable crop like wheat, you can then speculate on the price based on how next year's harvest might go, based on how demand might change over the year.
So they might
So,
say, oh, it would be this much because the sun sh because of the weather conditions.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's nothing like a war or a drought somewhere else in the world to push up prices for farmers. And that's pretty depressing. But yeah, so they might say, well, I'm going to sell everything this harvest immediately at the point of harvest because the price is good. Or they might say, well, actually, I think there'll be a shortage of wheat in the global market after Christmas, so I'm going to hold on to it in my store and hopefully sell at a higher price. Or they might say, I'm going to sell at a price that's for 2 years' time. I'm going to really speculate on the futures market, and I'm going to do that. Or they might just say, I'm going to go into a pool with a whole other group of farmers. We're going to sell into a trade price now, and we're going to let someone else do the speculation, and they might give us a higher price on the basis that they think they're cleverer than the market.
I'm assuming that in order to do that, they've got to have some money in the bank because they're holding on to all their crop, hoping, and they're not having the money back in the bank. So they paid everything to grow it. They've paid their everyone's, salary. So in order to hang on to it, they've got to have a bit of money to do that. You've got to have some reserves because if you're waiting for your money.
Yes, so you're absolutely right. Arable farmers essentially are producing one harvest a year, and that's what they get paid for. And so they might be being paid through the year because of the way that they've made arrangements to sell on the futures market, or they might be taking everything at harvest.
Doesn't sound like they have a lot of choice at this point. I mean, we've sort of digressed. So just to go backwards, where did they have to get that grain from that they grow? I
Well,
mean,
there's the interesting thing. So those four big global companies that are trading,
that buy the grain.
yeah, they also sell the seed. So those same companies control.
This sounds like mafia to me. This is Italian. I'm half Italian. This is mafia strategy, Josiah. Let me get this right. We sell you the grain, and we're the only people who can buy the grain. This is
So
Welsh shit.
those
Come
big
on.
companies
What are the names?
control.
Do you know the names of these big companies? What are these big people that control the world?
Well, they control 60% of seed sales globally, and that's for those commodity crops.
So are they names we would recognize?
I think some you would. So one of them is Cargill, based in the US. And Cargill is the it's a family-owned business.
Welcome back, Mafia. Yeah,
which is charming.
is there a Cargill Godfather?
that is a business that has more billionaires in it than any other family-owned business in the world.
There's
So,
so much synergy here going on, so continue.
and then you've got ADM, Archer Daniel Midland, also a US-based company
Okay.
that trades globally in all commodities. And I think it'd be fair to say that these companies are not just trading in food, they're trading in commodities. So they also trade in things like energy, they trade in seeds, they trade in the finished product, and they also sell a lot of agrochemicals. So not only are they selling you the seed to grow in the first place, they're selling you an agronomic package. So they'll offer you the chemicals that you need to produce the optimum yield for the crop that you'll then sell back to them.
So they're breeding the seeds and have got the seeds that actually essentially need the chemicals. So they've actually got a closed loop here.
Yeah, it is a, it, and that consolidation has happened increasingly over the last 20 years. So as seed companies have merged and been taken over by these bigger companies.
So we've got Cargill, ADM, and what do you remember the other two at all just by?
Yeah, they're called ABCD. So Archer Daniel Midland, Bunge, which is Bunge, Louis Dreyfus, and they essentially control seed market and the grain trading market globally. There are other big companies. There's Sinochem, which is a big Chinese chemical conglomerate which controls a lot of agricultural inputs. But
And they're another one.
yeah, exactly. So there's a whole set of companies that essentially have emerged as agriculture has consolidated, mainly in what we think of as the West, in Northern Europe, in green revolution countries like India, China, and North America. The majority world, so what you might call the global South, that is still dominated by small scale farmers. And it is small scale farmers that actually produce most of the food in the world, but they have less visibility.
Okay, so we've got the farmer is buying their seeds and the necessary agrochemicals to make those seeds grow optimally, and
Yeah, and
then having
I think
to
it'd be it's
sell
in...
the seeds back to the same people that they're growing for, and that sets the price, or they can have a bit of a gamble and hope to get more money by selling it later. That's how our farmers are, no way, they're trapped, just
Yeah,
like
so
that.
those four big companies essentially setting the price. There are other traders in the UK that are working to those global commodity prices.
But they are also within a commodity market. So this is a
Yeah.
commodity market.
Yeah,
Right, okay.
exactly. And I think to be really clear about the seeds, I mean, the seeds perform well under very particular sets of conditions,
Yeah, which
which is,
involves spending money on the agrochemicals. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
okay. Yeah, that becomes quite clear. So I'm seeing a very harsh reality of those farmers being blocked. Now,
Yeah, I mean,
from stepping out.
it's called the commodity trap.
Okay, good. Tell me about this commodity trap.
It is essentially that you're absolutely right. You have very limited options. You have geared your farm towards serving that commodity market, which means you've increased your field sizes, you've increased the size of the machinery you're using, you've reduced your staffing, you've done everything to trim costs and optimize the potential return from the commodity markets. The problem is, it's very, very difficult to then back away from that. You've got debts. That are associated with buying the large machinery, which is suited to that system, but might not be suited to an alternative model. You're tied into an agronomic system that favors those crops. So again, it's very difficult to just, become, for example, organic overnight. That is a hard thing to do. And you're tied into that route to market. So it's really, really difficult for farmers to make a switch.
But they must
And
be making a fortune. I mean, how much money is to be made from these crops, Josiah?
Yes, you would think, wouldn't you? And I think historically, particularly in the 80s and the early 90s, when agricultural production was much more directly supported by subsidies, that farmers, particularly in the east of England, did make good money. But that has not been the case really for the last 15 or 20 years. It's become increasingly difficult to run a profitable farm without direct payments, in one form or another, either for environmental goods or historically for food production just per se.
So, how much money do the farmers get per ton of wheat? What is it? Is it like a ton price?
It's a ton price. So at the moment, for milling wheat, so that's the sort of wheat that you'd be interested in for producing flour, farmers are getting somewhere in the region of 160 to £170 a ton.
Whoa, hang on a second. They're getting something like 16p a kilo. It was the supermarket selling this at £2 a kilo. Okay. Well, hold on a second. Where's the other? Where's the other £1.84 going?
So, I mean, I think the interesting thing is that no one's really making any money.
Hang on a second. Whoa. Because where's. So, farmer is getting about 16p per kilo. Okay.
So that.
Flour is roundabout. I mean, I'm just. I mean, I have to have a quick Google, but I mean, I'm going to like turn my phone off.
Yeah, I mean, you can get cheap flour, but
Okay, so even if we get cheap flour, there is a massive that
yeah.
where who where what.
So a few things happen. So most flour that you buy in the supermarket, or that's available, or that's used in baking, is white flour. So the grain goes from the miller, from the farmer, sorry, via a trader, although the trader doesn't generally have anything to do with it directly, into the miller, and the miller is then producing the flour. And the
So
first
the
thing that
millers themselves are actually, this is the problem. So this, whoa, okay, this is interesting. So the farmer is not selling straight to the mill. He's going back to the trader, to the person, and then there, so the miller is going back up to the commodity market. So you already, there's a.
Yeah, and that in lots of respects that makes a lot of sense, because it means that you can go to one person and they can say, what specification do you need for your grain? What protein levels are you looking for? What Hagberg, what Fohling number do you want? How much do you need, and when do you need it by? And we'll make all of that happen. So for the miller, that's quite useful, and it works for the farmer as well,
The miller
because.
has basically outsourced the specification of the flour because he just wants to go, I want this Hagberg, this protein, thank you very much, deliver.
Yes.
It's convenient for the miller. So we've paid for that. Okay, so convenience for the miller. Okay, what? So the reason we have to have all these specifications is because we are going into an industrial unit to make bread that must behave in a particular way.
We're going into a system where there is little or no process flexibility. You pour in flour at one end, and literally you press a button and loaves come out at the other end.
So if the grain comes out of the fields and it's been a bit of a wet year, the next thing that I know that happens is that if the farmer was going to get a good price for it for food and it was a bit wet that year, then he has to sell it for a lot less money for animal food. Is that right?
Yeah, so there are two things that might happen. The farmer might take a penalty from the milling market.
So they
So
get
they,
punished for the weather.
yeah,
Wow.
and then it still goes into milling, but it's blended so that
That
ultimately we end
farmer,
up
you
with
made
a
it
or there's a sale into animal feed, which is lower value, or the farmer doesn't even bother trying to achieve the milling spec in the first place because they know there's a risk associated with that, so they just grow for the feed market. And 50%, roughly 50% of the wheat that you see in the fields in the UK is being grown just to feed animals.
Okay, and then we get into the vegan argument, but we won't go there yet. Right, okay. Well, I'll be a chat. Not very often I'm speechless, but here we go. Right, let's go back one. So from my point of view, a lot of these agrochemicals are causing global climate change, right? Because they're really, really hungry
Yeah,
for.
so synthetic nitrogen, which is made
Yeah.
through the Haber-Bosch process, which is essentially a process that grabs nitrogen out of the atmosphere, but it's very, very energy intensive. It uses a lot of natural gas,
Yeah.
is responsible for probably somewhere between 2.5 and 3% of all man-made climate emissions.
So they're making the farmers use the chemicals that cause climate change and then telling the farmer they have to accept a penalty because it rained and his crop didn't match the specifications.
Those things are not directly connected in that world, but yes.
Wow. Wow. This is special. Go on. So you're.
The miller then is obviously producing a specification which suits the bread manufacturer, the
Yeah.
baker,
Okay.
the industrial baker principally. Who again has a specification that they need to achieve in order to ensure that they're producing a loaf that suits the market that they're selling into, which we'll come to. But the miller uses a number of approaches to do that. One thing is that we have a market for white flour in the UK. And so that means using a milling process that removes the bran layer from the wheat, which has a secondary sale into animal feed or into
So the bit
cosmetics.
that nourishes our gut microbiome,
Yeah,
that provides
that's it.
substrate for our immune system to function and for all of
Yeah.
the nourishment that we need fundamentally to function as humans is removed from our bread
Yeah.
and then
Yeah.
fed to animals.
Yes, that's right. Sometimes it's used in other food products or in supplements or in cosmetics because it's very high in vitamin E, which you'd think you'd want to be eating it, but there you go. So that is one way or another, it goes into a different route or it's discarded. Sometimes it is just discarded, it's composted.
The
There's
maggot food compost, putting back on the fields of who I've spoken to this week with some of my farmers.
Yeah, exactly that. And that might amount to 20, 25% of the total grain weight that's going into the mill. So that £170 a ton, we're discarding 20, 25% of that because
Best bit, the most
we want
nourishing bit,
white
we're just
flour.
chucking. Right,
Yeah.
okay.
Yeah. And that's an area of land probably around the size of the Isle of Wight every year in the UK that is effectively dedicated to producing bran that we don't eat. So from a land use perspective, it doesn't really make any sense.
I mean, it's so broken that it's almost offensive, actually. Like,
So
even though I know this, just Siren, I know how, just listening, I actually feel offended at how broken this system is. That is the level of discard of the fiber that is needed.
yeah,
Like,
absolutely. And millers over the last 150 years or so have developed processes that allow them to very efficiently remove the bran, and that's principally the roller milling process, which peels the bran layer off, ensures that the endosperm is as pure as possible through a multiple pass process, which also heats up the grain, and that can also nutritionally damage the flour that you're eating at the end. And that produces a white flour. Sometimes it's a brown flour, and they do denature and then reintroduce the bran to the flour to produce a brown flour, which has a similar long shelf life to white flour. Because the problem with the bran, from the miller's perspective or from the baker's perspective, is that the bran is full of oils, which we might want to eat, but that also can lead to rancidity, which means that wholemeal flour might have a 6 month shelf life, whereas a white flour could have up to an 18 month shelf
Yeah,
life.
so the lipids have actually been essentially removed, giving it a longer shelf life. So the other interesting aspect of that, of course, is that in dismantling the matrix, even with a whole grain roller milled, what we see is raised blood sugar. So even that process of roller milling dismantles the matrix. So
Okay.
it's on every level. I mean, a lot of the studies have shown that whole grain roller milled is almost as bad for your blood sugar because your blood sugar just munches on the availability of carbohydrate and leaves the bran till later, thanks. It just doesn't, it still peaks. So this is still just as damaging.
Yeah, and obviously that yeah is a process that's designed to produce a very fine powder, which hydrates really quickly through the bread making process. Whereas stone milling essentially cuts and smears the grain, and it rubs the oils into the flour, and is not quite such a
The
destructive or hot
matrix is
process.
intact. A lot of workers, Dr. Sarah Barry and the Zoe have looked at matrices as of plants, and this ties in. So we've got to the stage where we've realized that so I still don't quite know where all that money's gone to, because when we sell flour, somewhere between the trader and the miller and the supermarket, they have essentially taken something like 84% of the cost of the price has gone over to them. That's not a fair proportion. Sorry. It's not a fair proportion. It looks like the farmer is always going to be on the back foot here. It doesn't look like they've got anywhere to go. So you have presented quite a shocking picture that most consumers have no idea is happening. Now,
I
you
mean, I think it's worse than that in a way, because those traders are not necessarily taking a huge amount of money. They're taking very, very small amounts of money, but they're taking a lot of it because they're trading tens, if not hundreds of thousands of tons. And it's the aggregation of those tiny amounts of money that makes them their money, but it's not actually a huge of money in itself. And they have to be at that scale in order for those businesses to work and to operate, because they were operating on such tiny margins.
Yeah.
And that's the same into the industrial bakery system as well, where everything is shaved to the absolute
Yeah.
narrowest margins.
I've witnessed 1p. I've had industrial bread makers here training them, watched a supermarket try and knock them down by a penny, and watched them go into a blind panic because there is no margin in it.
And then those industrial bread suppliers, who often operate on what are called open book terms with their supermarket customers. So the supermarket knows all of their costs and all of their variables and can support them in achieving
Oh, really?
better costs.
Yeah.
So they're then supplied
This is
into this.
that sort of mafia support, isn't it? They come to defend the shop against the people who would harm the shop. This is the mafia again, isn't it? We're supporting you.
And then those loaves go into those large retailers, who make what are very obviously and appear to be and are obscene profits, but they still operate at incredibly tight margins. So those profits are big because they've got so many retail outlets and they turn over such a lot of money. But actually, their margins are very fragile. I think that gives us hope, because those businesses are fundamentally quite fragile. They feel like they've been here forever, but really they've only been here for 70 years, and they could disappear as quickly as they appeared. But they're actually quite fragile businesses.
And looking, I mean, I'm just digressing slightly, but I was in Marks and Spencer's this week. I'm headed over to the bread section for a look-see at the bread section, and they were wheeling in clearly industrially sliced bread in big plastic factory boxes with labels on saying "hand sliced by your baker."
Yeah, I think
I've got to be kidding me. Like,
I think
there was a baker there with a knife just sitting there slicing your bread up for you. Mrs. Miggins, will you have three fat slices or thin slices? It's like they're pretending that these are artisan breads when they're actually industrial conglomerate mono breads. Absolutely obscene, really. Carry on, I'm digressing. But yeah, so the supermarkets, Josiah, they're taking these sort of liberties, really.
That's absolutely right. And I think what's interesting though is, and what's important is that we're all complicit in this. We have broadly a cheap food policy. We've had a system and a set of policy drivers that have encouraged us to think that food should be very cheap at the point of purchase. Supermarkets have supported that process, and it's helped them to outcompete independent rivals in that situation. But when you're asking where the money is actually in all of those externalities. Those externalities are what economists call externalities, a horrible word. They're very much internalities. But so things like our health have suffered, and we pay a huge NHS bill for the diet that we have, which is a consequence of that cheap food. We pay extra for our water in order to cover the cost of cleaning those agrochemicals out of the water and ensuring that the water is good to drink and is good for wildlife. We pay for that in soil degradation, in biodiversity loss, in, as you say, in the destabilization of our climate through land use change and through approaches to agricultural production. So all of those costs are there. We haven't paid them when we buy a loaf of bread, but they still exist
So we just
within.
pay them elsewhere. So
Exactly.
every time we shortchange the system, we're actually just picking up the real true cost in health, environment, and actually the true cost is just passed on to the next system.
I mean, I saw recently there was an article suggesting that in the UK, we throw away 24 million slices of bread every day. That's 12 million sandwiches. It's a huge amount of food. So that cheapness causes us not to necessarily respect that process, and we don't think about where the food has come from or who's grown it or how they've produced it. So, I mean, it's a complicated conversation because obviously accessibility of food and the fact that people are living on low incomes and are struggling to afford food, despite the fact that we have some of the cheapest food in the world, is massively problematic.
You see that kind of throwing away of food. I mean that the problem we've got now is that people are not valuing bread. It's been devalued to that level that instead of it being understood as the most affordable, nourishing, diverse fiber delivery system to support health and wellness and the environment. It's been reduced down to something that we throw 24 million slices of it away because it has no value for anything. No value for health, no value for as a food source. It's simply a calorie, a sort of plasticized calorie delivery system. Right, the opposite end before we all just dissolve into a puddle of doom here. Can't tap your work, Josiah.
Yeah, so our work is really about kind of
Let me pay your compliment. Your work, your work inspires, supports, and is a total system change on a level where you have actually, I've watched for I'm going to say, for more than years, and I'm going to say, you actually influence the whole of our community and brought everyone together into a group of people who are actually have put a boundary in and who have reinstated those connections. And that's why I want you on, for my podcast and for my students, because you light everyone's candle with your light and what you do. And the changes that you've done. So you saw all this a long, long time ago, and you have paved the way for so many people who either do or don't acknowledge what you've done. But come on, tell us what our alternative is here, because my job is to get artisan bakers and people who bake who are thinking about their food and their system and their health. To reconnect to the farmer, and that actually means that they need to plug into the new system and the alternative. Can you give us that alternative now, Josiah? What we've got?
Yeah, so I think part of it is moving away from the kind of reductivism and the abstraction that we have. And that might mean not just thinking about bread or flour or wheat. It's thinking about what the whole farm does and how that fits into a wider system.
And
So,
that's what you would call agroeconomics.
agroecology, yeah.
Okay,
So,
agroecology. Okay, yeah.
which is how things are run on the farm. So how are we using crop rotation, for example, this idea that crops are grown in a sequence that builds fertility in the soil so that one crop, for example, a bean or a pea crop, which is where we started, takes nitrogen from the atmosphere in the same way that the Haber process might, but using sunlight rather than natural gas, and works with bacteria to put nitrogen into the soil, which then benefits the following crops. That might be wheat.
So, hang on a second. So this is the exact opposite of these huge conglomerates. Instead of stealing the nitrogen and using it and polluting, we're actually using the natural process to fix the nitrogen in the soil whilst producing food to feed people.
Yeah, that's broadly it. It's
That's the complete opposite.
working with natural systems, and all farmers do this to a certain extent, but often in East Anglia in particular, where we're dominated by arable agriculture into commodity, we might see, two or three wheat crops, a barley crop, a break crop, which might be sugar beet or it could be beans, and really the crop nutrition, the food that those plants need to grow, is all coming from things that are applied to the field. And often those things are synthetic nitrogen and mined mineral nutrients, often that are
Oh
coming from
yeah,
North Africa. Yeah.
I read about this recently that I think did I see Jeremy Clarkson throwing something on his ground recently? Is that right? I don't know.
I have to confess that I do not follow Jeremy Clarkson's farming activities,
No, I
but
saw something on television. It was something I saw where they were throwing minerals on the field because there was lack of magnesium in the field.
Yeah. So
It
there are
was affecting
supplements.
the crop. So they'd mine something and then throwing it back on the. I can't remember. I think it was. It might have been Clarkson's farm. It might not have been, but I remember watching it. Okay.
That sort of process is used for kind of very small balancing of micronutrients in the field. But the
Okay.
macronutrients, so those are coming in mineralized form, and they're applied in quite in larger quantities. So yeah, so taking advantage of natural systems and working with them in order to produce the food, thinking about things like how does the ecology of the farm work? So do you need to use insecticides, for example, to manage pest problems, or can you use natural predators, and can you create a farm system that has hedgerows, that has areas that are left or are not farmed quite so intensely, that produce a bank of insects and birds and other creatures that can manage your potential pest problems? How do we have essentially an ecosystem that works harmoniously that also produces food?
So
And
it's
those.
quite interesting because visually, just talking on a podcast or talking here, when we were standing at Wakelands, one of the things that they had were these incredible avenues of trees and hedges that were absolutely beautiful. They were like something out of a picture book. But they also were preventing the spread of any rust or anything moving across the fields with the wind. By providing a break. So that was instead of spraying the field, this field had been designed and constructed in a way that actually gave natural support.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it really boils down to diversity. So those tree lines at Wakelands or in any agroforestry system, they do multiple things. They're creating a microclimate that suits the crops, that keeps it cooler in the summer. It keeps it counterintuitively, perhaps it holds moisture into the field. You'd think the trees would be sucking up all the water, but they're not. It provides a habitat for beneficial creatures. It offers a harvestable crop, so that might be timber trees, it might be fruit, might be nuts, could be all sorts of
So then
different
you've got
things.
more diversity within the
Yeah, and the system is more resilient. You have opportunities for other routes to market. You're bringing up nutrients from deeper in the soil that couldn't be accessed by the shallow roots of the annual crops like the wheat. So those are dropped onto the field when the trees shed their leaves.
Yeah, I was
So
just going to say, well, autumn, that's like a nourishment drop.
yeah,
Right. Okay.
exactly. Yeah. So
Cool.
all sorts of things are happening in those complex systems. But if you establish a farm that is doing all of that,
Yeah.
you need to change what happens beyond the farm gate. So you need a different route to market. You can't engage so readily with those commodity traders because you're not producing a uniform product that suits those specifications. So you need to find other places to sell what you've grown. And that's really where Hobmadod comes in. We see ourselves, we are a middleman, which is often seen as a really negative thing, but we think that can be quite an enabling place because we can connect farmers effectively directly with consumers, and we can send different signals to those farmers. We want to support the way that you're growing things.
You've also brought to the farmers all sorts of different grains and heritage grains and peas and beans and all the pulses and all of these amazing things that we as consumers who delight in having these incredible ingredients that are flavoursome and delicious and interesting to eat, and they get more money for it, right?
Yeah. So the diversity is supporting that system on the farm.
Yeah.
The only way that that system can work commercially for the farm is if there's a sale for
Yeah.
what they're growing. And that can also bring joy, flavor, and delight to us as people that are eating those foods that we might not otherwise have had access to or realized could exist. And it also brings, I think, from the farmer's perspective, a lot of those crops are quite small, perhaps. Yeah, lentils, for example, are grown on quite a small scale by the farmers we work with, and they fit into a more complex system. But they're also really interesting. So farmers have been de-skilled over the last 70 years. They've outsourced agronomy to their agronomist. The seed is, as we've discussed, supplied by a company that's also recommending the chemicals. They're told the price at which they are going to be paid for their grain and what specification it should meet. And the farmer has been reduced really to a sort of factory floor operative who just goes out and does field processes when they're told to. And I think what growing some of these more complex crops and developing these complex systems allows is for farmers to use their skills again, to rediscover their role as soil scientists, as plant biologists, as traders, as engineers and mechanics. And so growing some of these crops really just allows them to problem solve again and do what farming is, which is essentially continuous problem solving.
So, I mean, from my point of view, I mean, you say it like this is what I do, but actually, for those people who are listening, what Josiah actually does is he gets out in the fields with the farmers and is often offering help, support, advice, encouragement, and is actually, you are almost, I mean, you are like, I've seen what you do, and you actually give those farmers not just a market, but you give them confidence and support. And you've brought a whole community of people together to be able to step out of the system. But not only that, you've given people like myself and all of your customers, you've empowered us to actually put a boundary in and actually connect to the farmer. So you are like the fuse and the plug, Josiah. You make it all happen.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, yes. And I think the confidence building thing, you're absolutely right. The connection thing, I mean, one of the things that we did really early on, which seemed really obvious, was if they wanted, and they don't always want, if they wanted, we'd put the farmer's name on the packet
I love that.
of
I
whatever it
absolutely love
was we were
it.
selling.
I love it. I'm literally, I've got some oats over there, and I was like, oh, no, this is the name
And
of the
obviously, we know that supermarkets invent farms so that they can pretend that they have that connection. But it is amazing, the number of times when farmers say, okay, so it's not part of the economic relationship that we have, but the reward I get from seeing my name on a packet in a shop is huge. Or the feedback I get, our customers, because of the transparency, our customers are welcome to find the farmers that we work with, either on social media or by other means, turn up on farm walks or whatever. That is a huge reward in itself, and I think not to be underestimated, because if you're particularly if you're an arable farmer, it can be quite a lonely life. you know,
Yeah.
you're in your
But that,
tractor.
well, actually, you know, there were some statistics I remember very, really painful that I don't want to sort of make everybody feel awful here, but farmers have one of the highest rates of suicide in
That's absolutely
the
right.
very, very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely right. And so just making that connection is a huge part of the value in what we're doing.
Connection.
And I think that's really quickly become obvious. And I think the sort of traditional the system that we described at the beginning that we chatted about before is very linear. It starts on the farm, it ends in a slice loaf in a sandwich shop or on your plate or wherever. And there are sort of gatekeepers that prevent information and knowledge moving down that, sometimes intentionally because they want to obfuscate and they don't want to be transparent. Sometimes just because of the nature of commodity and aggregation, it's impossible to know who grew your wheat for your bread. And I think what we talk about a lot is about, you know, how do we create networks, webs, connections, which have information flowing in all sorts of different directions, so that we're not a gatekeeper for the information about how the crop is grown or who grew it. We're not standing in the way of a food writer who wants to speak directly to a farmer or whatever it happens to be. And how do we facilitate a kind of feedback system that gets a response back to the farmer very quickly, or to a policymaker, or to an academic who's doing some research work, or to a baker who wants to learn how to produce a loaf using different ingredients? How do we make all that happen much faster? Because the problems we're facing globally are increasingly pressing and critical, and we need responses and we need answers quickly. And the only way we can do that is by communicating better.
So, onto that communication, Josiah. I mean, obviously, we're on a podcast here, and I'm going to come back to a question in a second of what you would, if you could get people to do one thing. We've obviously got a little bit of good news coming, and that we're looking at a few small changes around the botanical blend flower. When I first came to you with the botanical blend flower, I'd had three millers who told me it can't be done. You obviously didn't know that it couldn't be done at the time.
We found out that it couldn't be done pretty quickly.
Listening to the podcast, I'm going to use the royal we broke the mill.
So when you first came to us with the botanical blend formulation, we'd really only just bought a small mill, and we didn't really know much about milling, to be
And you didn't
completely
know it could be
honest.
done.
And so we couldn't understand how it could be so difficult. We did speak to some other millers who said, "I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole." And so it was almost a year really of working out, in some cases, some really kind of fine tuning to the blend. Actually, we need to reduce the oats by 1% because they're a bit oily, and we've worked out exactly where that tipping point is in the mix. Or we need to introduce smaller sized flower petals
Particles, yeah. We can't give
because
it all away yet, but
they get
we've worked it out. Just like to you, I mean, this is determination. Great. To you, what do you love about it? What's remarkable about it for you?
I think what's amazing about it for us, because we're involved in the process, is we have a very small mill room, and the mill, when it's milling the botanical blend, the smell is just extraordinary. It's aromatic in ways that are really hard to describe, and people are always delighted, I think is the best word for it, but and also surprised at how much of a sort of physical engagement they get with the flower when it's being milled,
A
because
meadow.
it really does smell like it really does have that smell. It's quite extraordinary. All flowers have a great smell when you're milling them fresh, but there is something about the botanical blend. It's just so vibrant and complex.
And then looking at that crop rotation, when we've got in the blend, we've got pseudograins, we've got botanicals, we've got legumes, and we've got grains. That is quite remarkable because it's supporting all 4 years of that regenerative farming process. Even if it's not on the same farmers, it's still supporting all 4 years.
Yeah, I think that's really important, you know, that we need to develop higher value sales, routes to market, whatever you want to call them, for all parts of the rotation. We can't just focus on one bit. And you're right, blends like that, mixes. And I think putting some of those ingredients that people don't conventionally think of as bread ingredients into the flour is really, really important, because they're bringing all sorts of, well, as is the whole purpose, they're bringing all sorts of nutritional advantages. And I think we talked right at the beginning about ecosystems and thinking of the farm as an ecosystem. And obviously, we need to think of our bodies as an ecosystem that is connected to those wider land and farm ecosystems and the soil ecosystem. And so all of those things need to be operating and working harmoniously. And the botanical blend is a part of that harmonious process, reflecting what's happening on farm, but also some of the wild species that might be growing around the field, like the cornflowers, for example. And thinking about our gut ecology, and then thinking about the soil ecology that produced those crops in the first place. I think that's just so fascinating.
And I mean, just coming back, the work I did showed mental health improvement and mental resilience. So when we're talking to people who are listening to this, would you say that there is a direct connection between mental health and caring about what we're eating?
I think there probably is for a lot of people, but I think I'd go a bit further than that, and I'd say that there's a physical relationship between consuming the botanical blend and consuming good flour and bread, that makes us feel happier, and that's a biochemical response essentially. But I think beyond that, also, if you were to walk into the fields that are growing the crops that produce the botanical blend, you'd also feel that. Because of the beauty that you'd experience, and because of the sensory inputs you get around that. So there's many layers to the sort of health benefits of those crops. And I think if more people had the opportunity to experience them growing in the field, you would get an even richer set of responses. But
But you also, I know I'm going to touch on this briefly, you also have Henrietta who's joined to be making bread, so people can actually buy some of your own bread from Holman Dodds as well now. And that's just on the website, click an order and arrive at your door.
I think we don't know for sure, but we're pretty certain we're probably, and this is either a damning indictment or something to be excited about, we think we're the only dedicated wholemeal mill and baker in the UK, which says a lot about the system.
No, I again setting precedent. Right, so we have to close, and I'm going to ask you have an opportunity to burrow into the brains of our listeners and my students, especially Desire. You can call to action anything you want of our listeners right now. What are you going to ask of them?
I suggest this a lot, and I think it's really important, and it's affected change in other spaces, particularly around fair trade and things like that, and where our international food is coming from. And I think it's a really simple thing, and it can sound quite facile, but just ask where an ingredient has come from. And do that even if you're in the supermarket. Find someone, present them with the packet of whatever it is, and say, "Can you tell me who grew this?" And they won't have an answer more often than not. They won't know. But challenging people to think about that, particularly if it's a manager, someone who theoretically has some responsibility for what's on the shelves, then I think that's just an important way of starting a conversation and beginning to think. It doesn't need to be done aggressively, but it can be done in a kind of charming and interested way. I'm really interested to know. This says product of more than one country. Can you tell me which country? Can you tell me who grew it? Why don't we know who grew this? I think that's a really important question to be asking, and a relatively straightforward one. And I think with the kind of ersatz, the fake farms, just say, "Oh, this is interesting. Where is this farm? Can you point to it on a map for me?" And
Marketing
I think
department.
just stimulating those kind of conversations, and because I think a lot of people go through their lives, particularly employed in those retailers, and they are. It's a particular kind of job, and I think often people that work in it are quite detached from what it is that they're actually selling, what the nature of the thing that they're actually selling, and they might enjoy those conversations as well.
So this ties into my sort of closing. For my students this week, they have come on a course to learn to make bread, and their first job has been to find a farmer, and they're all looking a little ensconced because they were expected to be pulling loaves out of the oven this week. I'm like, find your farmer. Just so you've got your grains, a lot of them with the farmer names on. You know all your farmers personally. Fantastic. And roughly how many do you have in the
I mean, it varies between year to year, and I'd say we have a wider group of farmers that we don't necessarily buy from every year as well, and that's part of what we do.
So how much is like
But
and how many we
I
if
don't know, it's probably 30 or 35, something like that, maybe a few more
okay.
now, I'm not sure. But I mean, it's a fun challenge, and it's not an easy one either, because there aren't many farmers relative to everyone else. And they're not necessarily very visible because they're not standing in the field with a hoe. And it's difficult to know when you drive past a field or cycle past a field or walk through a field who actually owns it. That's not clear very often. So it's actually not, that's a quite a fiendish job you've set your students.
It is. But I want to just say to you, thank you, because what you have done is made the farmers accessible to us. And that it makes all the difference in the whole world for me to be able to teach and share and put into our community, to be able to connect people back to those farms, Josiah, is remarkable. And I'm very grateful and I'm very appreciative as someone who leans into what you do all the time. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Vanessa. I think it's really clear to say that that only works if people are eating the things that the farmers are growing. So, likewise, the work that you're doing to change the way people eat and think about their food is just so critical.
Compelled to do it like you, I think. Josiah, thank you.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Amazing. Brilliant.
If you enjoyed listening to that podcast as much as I enjoyed chatting with my guests, then you might like to find out a little bit more about what I do. Well, I teach courses both online and in person at thesourdoughschool.com. I also write regularly for sourdough.co.uk, and I have a couple of Instagram accounts that you might like to follow: Sourdough School, Sourdough Club. Oh, and I have a personal one, Vanessa Kimball. I really do love to hear people's thoughts and feedback about, well, the books I write, the podcast, the features, or if you have any questions, don't hesitate to get in touch. Thank you for listening.